Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off-Broadway, and around the world. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Carmen Pavlovich. As the head of the Sydney-based company Global Creatures, Pavlovich is a producer behind stage shows that travel the world, with a portfolio that includes stadium spectacles like Walking with Dinosaurs, as well as musicals like Muriel's Wedding, Strictly Ballroom, King Kong, and the current Broadway success, Moulin Rouge. With shows currently running or planned to be running across multiple continents right now, Pavlovich has a notably international perspective on the theater business and on the current challenges of the coronavirus pandemic. Joining me from Sydney, she's in the virtual studio with me to tell us about producing a Broadway hit and then putting it on pause from half a world away.
Hi, Carmen. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Gordon. Nice to be talking to you from what's sunny Australia at the moment.
Oh, yes. Nice. As you mentioned, you are in Sydney right now. What's life like over there?
We are just coming out of our summer into autumn. So thankfully not on the back of a flu and cold season like you are in the Northern Hemisphere. But I'd say, look, from a lockdown point of view, it's pretty similar to what other countries are going through around the world. We're on pretty tight restrictions, working from home, homeschooling from home, not really supposed to leave home unless it's for exercise, groceries, or some sort of medical care.
And theaters are also shut down.
Yeah, theaters are shut down. It's slightly, I think we kind of followed the West End a little bit more than the US, where for us on Broadway, it was obviously mandated as a close down in London, and here in Australia, it was a kind of recommendation from government, which I must say caused quite a lot of confusion here. And in the West End as well. So I'd say from a shutdown point of view, we're going through pretty similar times. But then just, you know, if we're looking kind of, I suppose, at the difference between us as countries, Australia started with a similar kind of spread to what you had in the US and what we followed in the UK. But, we've got a lot of space in this country. And like I said earlier, we're coming out of summer. So I guess we haven't sort of had this toll taken on people's health generally. And we've got a very, very equitable and robust health system here. So, you know, free testing and very widely available testing from early on has meant we've got a wildly lower morbidity rate than other countries around the world. So, everybody's grappling here with the same sort of issues about, you know, what reopening might look like and what those conditions might be for us as a country as a whole and then industry specific as well. So a lot of similarities, but then, you know, I'd say, as I said, from particularly from a healthcare point of view, very different outlook.
And as we're recording this right now, it's been about 6 weeks since the Broadway shutdown. What was it like for you navigating that with your cast and your crew and your investors and everyone involved from so far away?
Yeah, it's pretty intense, pretty intense. I was in the US for most of February. Started off with the Broadway Across America Conference in the Bahamas. We had the Moulin Rouge cast perform there. And then I went on to New York for a few weeks. We had a reading of Muriel's wedding script going on there, and of course a lot of work happening on planning or putting the finishing touches on a few big months of planning for Moulin Rouge. So I was there for all of February, and the situation was certainly ramping up while I was there. And actually we were starting to get quite a lot of illness in the building, but yeah. I was just really struck by, you know, the amount of colds and flu that were in New York at the time. And I look back now and I just think, wow, I think that was all on the move a lot earlier than people thought. But of course, as things were moving, we were having a lot of conversations. I mean, I, you know, at the best of times, I'm at my desk by 7 a.m. because that's how I connect with the U.S. time zone. So that part of life is pretty much like another day at the office for me. But certainly during that period in, you know, early March, we were really intensely on calls every day. And then I sort of open my eyes in bed at, you know, about 6 o'clock, and I'd look at my phone and, you know, see were the messages like, please call, please call, please call as soon as you wake up, or oh God, what's my phone going to look like this morning? And I kind of, and then I'd start waking up at 5, and then I'd start waking up at 4 a.m. because I just think, oh my God, what is happening over there? Because my overnight is your daytime. I'm, you know, just thank God, just blessed with Bill Damaschke as my producing colleague there, and
yes,
Aaron
Lasbader
as the general manager. Yeah. And yeah. You look, we're very like-minded, the three of us, with very similar values, and they certainly know my feelings about, you know, showing leadership and communication at a time like this and really trying to take care of the people. So we did bring in a number of initiatives pretty early on, and we were having deep cleaning in the theatre, et cetera. And the day the governor announced a shutdown of Broadway, we'd actually pulled a matinee that afternoon of our own accord. And that was a pretty upsetting morning. Actually, I said I woke at 5, and Bill had rung me during the night, and I'd said, please, you know, call, I'm here anytime and I want to be part of the conversations. And for some reason I'd had my phone on silent and missed it, and I was so upset when I woke up thinking, oh my God, all these things are happening. But, you know, thankfully there's people there that could make really great judgments, and, you know, certainly had blessing to do that. Yeah. So it is tricky because, of course, at that time everybody wants to talk, and I still find it, I'm sure you do, every call you go on, people want to talk about what's happening in your country at the moment about COVID-19, what's everybody's kind of thinking about how we're going to come out of it. So it was an incredibly intense couple of weeks of just trying to get to everybody as fast as we could. Looking at cash flows, how we're going to pay people, what's each country doing, Australia and the UK and America, North America, because we have plans in both the North American tour and Broadway, and just looking at the different responses of each of those countries, just from an insurance perspective and a healthcare perspective and a economic rescue package point of view. I mean, we just had to go through each country and audit a whole lot of criteria and then weigh up what our respective staff and plans were in each of those countries. So I did find myself on a, you know, like a 24-hour cycle in those early days because I get to the end of the Australian workday and go, okay, so now London's just waking up, and then we deal with that all night, and then we'll go to bed and I think, oh my gosh, I've got to get up really early and sort of see what's happening in America. So,
And how many, for Global Creatures, how many productions overall are we talking across how many continents? Because just for Moulin Rouge alone, you've got the Broadway production and you've already got plans in the works, and, you know, you're sort of gearing up for, you know, London and Australia. What, how, talk me through the number of productions that you were dealing with through all this.
I mean, obviously the bulk of it for us is Moulin Rouge related at the moment. I mean, certainly we have Broadway, obviously, and the North American tour is due to go out this fall. And then we have the West End gearing up. That is due to open in March of next year and was due to go on sale in March of this year. So we were literally about to push a button on, you know, rolling out this big on sale campaign in London when we had to close everything down. And then Australia has been announced as well, and that season is due to start in July of next year. And likewise, starting in July, that's right. Likewise, we were gearing up to put that on sale in July of this year. So, We actually had auditions happening in Australia, and we shut those down kind of halfway through the audition process. We had auditions scheduled for the West End for April and then finals again for May, so all of the auditions had to be pulled. I mean, probably I'd say in the kind of 12 years that I've been growing this company, the next 4 months, kind of, you know, April through to June, were probably really the most heavily scheduled we've ever had in the country's, in the company's life, disappointingly. And we've really worked very hard these last months of last year, putting in plan all these putting in place all these plans that we were just about to hit a button on from April onwards. So has been an awful lot to unpick. And then, I mean, these are not announced productions, but we're certainly in discussions and planning for Moulin Rouge productions in various territories, including Japan and throughout Europe, and, you know, possible productions in Germany, Holland, Spain. Then in Asia, we mentioned Japan. We're also looking at productions in Korea. So all of those were afoot in terms of deal-making and potential dates for scheduling auditions, and of course our creative team, and just looking at even that rollout alone of how you schedule a creative team for so many international productions, and if it's not them, it's their associates, and have we got enough associates, and how do we train them worldwide? So all of those plans are afoot. And then Muriel's Wedding, we mentioned that we had a reading of that in New York in February, and then we were gearing up to a six-week lab for that production in New York that was supposed to happen over April and May, so we had to cancel that. And then our old friend King Kong, we've been working on a production going to China, and we had a session planned with a creative team. We're looking at taking that down to a 90-minute version of the show. So we had a session planned, well, that was going to be in Australia at the end of April, and we were flying out, you know, people from America and London, and we're well down the path with planning that, so we had to pull that as well. Yeah, and then we were actually Walking with Dinosaurs has just finished an international world tour, and we think that's the last time our beloved dinosaurs will go out. So we were looking at having a little bash back here in Australia to celebrate that production and what it's meant to our company. So we've had to cancel that. So, I mean, that's pretty well everything, I think, but it's a lot.
And so how do you – it must have been – particularly hard as, you know, the people that you mentioned that you had a lot of sickness in the building at Moulin Rouge. Yeah. And then, you know, both Aaron Tveit and Danny Burstein have been very public about the fact that they tested positive for coronavirus and had to deal with it. And they're both doing better now. But how do you talk to people who are involved in all these productions now? How do you even begin to plan for the future and talk them through kind of what the what's ahead for the shows and for them?
With Moulin Rouge specifically for Broadway?
For instance.
Yeah. So we did have an incredible amount of illness in COVID-related illness in our building. I mean, you know, we're kind of up to 20, 21 people who have tested positive, and I really am very grateful that we were able to move very, very quickly early on. As soon as we saw a couple of temperatures in the building, we did connect with a doctor and get the whole company tested. And I mentioned, you know, to you that that matinee we took down because of temperatures, and those particular temperatures did return positive tests. So it meant we were really on the front foot, which was a relief, and it meant, you know, the cast, of course, all went right into isolation. So we've been, you know, just very nervously waiting to see how everybody fares, and it's been fascinating the, you know, the mixed reactions that people have had, which have really varied from a couple of very low-level crumbly signs through to some people being a lot sicker but still remaining home, through to, you know, a couple of people, including Danny, obviously, who really ended up being much, much more sick. And I, you know, we had a cocktail Zoom with the cast of Moulin Rouge yesterday, which for me was 7 a.m. So I put on my red lipstick and red top and pretended to make myself an espresso martini. But it was so lovely to see everybody. It's very emotional, actually. And I hung back and just chatted with Danny a little at the end, and, you know, I can see he's really, it's a great trauma to have seen your life flash before you, and I can see he's swinging with the you know, sort of philosophical largesse of it, and the kind of, you know, just the anxiety, and then, you know, having good days where he just feels so grateful. And I just thought, said to him, this must be just such a big, big experience to process, and one that's probably changed you forever. In terms of our Moulin Rouge cast, we, you know, there's not a lot one can formally say, which is really frustrating in terms of what the future plans will be. But what we have been able to say to everybody, and this is where I feel incredibly blessed, is that Moulin Rouge will be back. You know, it's a a big, bold international copyright, and this a show that I hope can really take a leadership role and become some kind of beacon, not just for Broadway, but in the West End and here in Australia and in other countries, where it's a show that is very joyous. It's a show that's got a lot of hope, and it's a show that we try and embody its values in everything we do, of truth, beauty, freedom and love. And, you know, we think and talk a lot about that at the moment, and how we can kind of inspire and invigorate people in various communities around the world. And I think, you know, everybody in their respective casts, and not just the cast, obviously there's very big teams of people behind the scenes, crew, musicians, management, everybody feels very inspired by the opportunity to take that role in the future. And it's tempting to, you know, in the early days of this, I thought, oh, it's so unfair. You've worked for 12 years to finally have a show on Broadway that's working, and, you know, all these plans. And I did feel sorry for myself for a couple of days, but boy, that didn't last long, because I just looked around me and I thought, wow, just shut up, Carmen. I mean, you know, we're very, very blessed, very blessed. We had cash flow. We have an advance. We have a copyright that people are interested in around the world. So, you know, we do just really talk with everybody about that, that there will be a future. We're just busy trying to work out what it is, and that the path hasn't yet quite revealed itself.
I'll have more with Carmen right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
And now here's more with Carmen Pavlovich of Global Creatures.
Actually, let's turn toward Global Creatures in general. How big is Global Creatures? And tell us a little bit about, you mentioned it's been 12 years now since you... since the company launched in 2008. Tell us a little bit about sort of what it is and what its specialties are.
Yeah, we're not a big company. People frequently think we are. People think we're some kind of studio, and that, you know, my business partner is just some really rich guy that kind of chucks money around. I mean, it's so funny to me. This has been a bit of a narrative over the years when I was that dinosaur company. I'm like, well, Walking with Dinosaurs is a production that really kickstarted the company back in 2007, but it was a standalone production. It wasn't run by Global Creatures at that point. But Jerry Ryan, who's now my business partner, we own the company together, I said to him, I'm not interested in coming back to Australia to just do what most companies in Australia do, which is replicate Broadway and West End shows. I want to create content in Australia, flip the model that we can take to the world. And Jerry is not someone who came from a theatre background, but he just sort of loved the idea of the innovation of it, I suppose, and, you know, making Australia a first in that regard. So he got on board and funded Overhead very early on. So that gave me room to go out and secure titles. I thought, well, I don't want to just keep coming up with shows that are about animatronics because I'll make really bad choices. And also the animatronics are really expensive and really take a very long time to development. It's all boutique technology. None of it, it's all bespoke. You know, every show had to sort of have its own plan, and it just really, you know, the development time is very long. So I did start thinking, well, you know, my aspiration for the company is not just to be a show, a company that makes shows about creatures or has animatronics. I want to tell international stories or stories that appeal to international audiences and appeal because they have universal themes and they're very relatable. So, of course, then the next phase of the company was securing titles like Strictly Ballroom and Moulin Rouge and Muriel's Wedding, which we then spent, you know, the second sort of half of this decade developing, and then in the last couple of years starting to take them out around the world. Yeah. Right.
And how you mentioned you have experience in all sorts of territories all around the world. What makes Broadway unique and or uniquely difficult in terms of producing a show here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm loving the whole Broadway experience in just sort of a massive way. I think essentially it's just that the stakes, what makes it so unique is that the stakes are so high, and that is a real blessing and it's a real curse.
Is this because of the visibility of Broadway? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, I'd say it's partly visibility and partly a cost factor so on both those fronts, you're heavily rewarded in success and heavily punished in failure, both from a kind of, a critical point of view and the associated visibility of that. And then just from a cost point of view, you know, it's no secret that producing shows on Broadway is, probably the most expensive market in the world. And in the early days of Moulin Rouge, I did really think a lot about, should I open it in the West End or should I open it on Broadway? And this was a big sort of internal struggle for many years for me. And, you know, many people would say to me, but so much cheaper in the West End. You know, you'll open it up much more economically in the West End. I was like, yes, but correspondingly, you don't get the same box office that you can get on Broadway in success. So it's, you know, it's pretty incredible when I look at the both King Kong and Moulin Rouge, actually, were both selling about 10,000 tickets a week. Moulin Rouge is a very hot ticket, so I had a much higher average ticket price, and King Kong obviously was not a hot ticket, so I had much lower average ticket price. Therefore, we just couldn't get that box office up to sustain the costs. Right. I do really love, I mean, you know, the community factor is undeniable, and that is a real privilege and a great pleasure to be part of. I've always been told, you know, over the years that Broadway doesn't like outsiders and, you know, you won't be accepted, but I just haven't experienced that at all. I really haven't. I just haven't found that to be true. I have felt very welcome there. At every level, actually, amongst the agents and media and within the kind of producing community, incredibly collegiate. That's actually been a real pleasure and a real career highlight for me, I will say. And probably, you know, as a function of the pedigree and history and just the geography of Broadway, it means it can be highly organized. So, you know, there's a level of organization there and sort of benchmark and expectation and sort of set of rules for everything that, you know, I often sort of get asked to agree to something in a deal. And I think, oh my gosh, if I do say yes, it becomes the new black for everybody on Broadway. And so I'm always mindful of that. But it is, like, from an organizational point of view, really very clear set of guidelines and expectations about how kind of, you know, just deals and day-to-day happenings work. So that part of it's been really great. Yeah. And then, of course, I mean, just the quality of the work that's there. I mean, wow, isn't it just what a remarkable time. I spent a lot of time in New York in December seeing shows, and I just felt high as a kite thinking that look at the level of work that's here at the moment. It's really, really extraordinary. What a great time to be part of Broadway. Well, not this particular moment, but
yeah.
Now, well, actually, even now, I'll rephrase that, because I do feel, even now in this moment of just unbelievable hardship, and you know, you think, gosh, we'll be talking to our grandchildren about this period of time. There is something, you know, I feel like we're part of a legacy moment for sure, and that is difficult, but it's a great, great privilege as well, and to think about what contribution we can make to that and how we rebuild this community coming out of it is something I wouldn't shy away from as an opportunity to contribute to.
Yeah. You mentioned King Kong, and that had a long and windy road to finally making it to New York. What do you consider that show's biggest successes? What are you most proud of about that show?
Look, I have a lot of thoughts about King Kong, of course, because it's been a very long and very unique journey. I'm really proud, and I will always be proud of the commitment to innovation with that production, with the puppetry and the sheer kind of boldness of it. I did think there was a lot that really succeeded creatively in the production itself, and, you know, I feel really not shy to say that I also think creatively there's a lot that didn't succeed. It's a very tricky proposition to make work, but I do feel that it delivered, you know, good or bad, it delivered something that audiences haven't seen on stage before. And I just personally, as a theatre maker, would rather say that I worked on a show and was able to help facilitate a show that did that rather than something that wasn't adventurous. I think a lot, you can imagine it was a pretty strange week for me to announce on a Tuesday to the King Kong cast that the production was closing, and 2 days later on a Thursday night, Moulin Rouge had its first sold-out preview with such sort of buzz and expectation around it, and I just thought, wow, this is really a very pretty schizophrenic week. I've never worked on a show that was so close to being a hit and so far from being a hit commercially. Like, it just, as I said, to kind of sell 10,000 tickets a week on Broadway, yet still not be able to really kind of feel like we had this show that people were falling over themselves to see. It was such a kind of schizophrenic feeling, and we'd often puzzle it with the marketing agency. You just go, wow, there are a lot of ticket buyers there, but this show's really not just found its place on Broadway and amongst that Broadway community. You know, there's so many things I think, oh, should we have made it a play? Should we have made it a ballet? Should we have not done it at all? Should we have whatever? But I'll always be grateful for that production, and I still am really fond of it, and I'm excited about taking it to China, and I'm excited about what that show could look like. And as I said, I just look at, you know, the puppetry alone and think of that incredible achievement. I mean, you know, to sort of say, oh, what? Wonder if we can make a show of King Kong work, and to actually go from that to delivering that extraordinary puppet and that incredible idea of the King's Company being the kind of human energy breathing life into animatronics and automation. I'm very grateful for that experience. It was tough. I mean, it was pretty brutal. Speaking of the stakes being high and low, I mean, there's no denying it was a pretty brutal experience. And just, you know, to make a hit is as much hard work as making a flop. And, you know, there's a level of, I think people, if we don't sort of support and embrace that kind of risk-taking, that's a bad outcome for our industry. So I line up Moulin Rouge and Broadway, and I think it's the same people, Moulin Rouge and King Kong, and I think, well, it's the same people behind both. It's the same kind of boldness, the same innovation. There was a version of Moulin Rouge that might not have gone very well despite expectations. You know, you think on paper the creative teams are all, you know, remarkably accomplished, all of them. And as a company, we supported very long development periods for both. So I guess that's just the nature of the business.
Yeah. And you mentioned Muriel's Wedding and the reading that was going to happen and then is now postponed for a bit. What's the plan for Muriel's Wedding? To bring it to New York here at some point?
Well, I mean, we haven't got a plan to, but I'd, you know, certainly like to try. We developed that production and premiered it at Sydney Theatre Company a few years ago, and then we had a commercial run through Australia. The show did very well in Australia, which was lovely. It got a great critical reception both times. I think it's a show I'd say I feel really proud of. I think it's really hit the right tone in terms of comedy and the more serious nature of the piece, the sort of darker elements that lie underneath. I'm really proud of the way the score and the book have come together, and you know, it was a question early on of how on earth could we make ABBA songs sit next to original music and not flash forward to reviews where, you know, you can imagine them, oh, the new music felt bolted on, or, oh, the only good bit was the ABBA songs.
Right.
And to ask composers to go up against ABBA and write music that would sit alongside them was, you know, big, big question. But I think the score that Kate and Keir have delivered has just been really phenomenally great, and the piece feels really cohesive, and certainly that was reflected in all of the reviews. So I was wondering whether to an American ear this piece would work, and whether it would resonate, and whether that quirky sort of Australian humour would land. So I was very keen to hear it read in New York, and I also wanted to hear whether what the Australian accent sounded like, and did they sound pantomime-like, or did they sound like real people? So we did that process in February, and it was wonderful, and I thought really inspiring to all of us to think that there might be a life for Muriel's Wedding in America with American audiences. So, yeah, we were gearing up to the lab in April as a next step.
And is there anything else you have in development that you can tell us about?
We have other things in development, but I can't name them yet, I'm afraid. But they're not, you know, they're very, very early days. There's a couple of projects that we are just kind of tinkering at the edges with. I think, you know, I really wanted, in my plan was to get Moulin Rouge secure through its first year on Broadway and rolling out of this first wave of big territories with the tour and the West End, and we were just keeping these sort of productions in the background, and then of course, you know, we've all been slowed down and derailed somewhat. But it's also a great time to bring everybody back to a creative place of thinking and being and writing, and you know, in some ways we're busier than ever, and in other ways I think it's the perfect moment for us to be putting some emphasis back onto the creative development side of new projects. So funnily enough, we do have some meetings scheduled next week by Zoom, of course, to try and take some of these new projects forward. But for me, you know, they'd be probably another 5 years away, something like that. I mean, I don't know, these projects all just take so long to develop and get up. Yeah.
Yeah. And looking ahead in general with the perspective that you have, having worked on these shows sort of all over the world, what do you feel are the challenges for theater as it picks itself up, and how do you expect it to change short term, long term?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably our biggest challenge right now is uncertainty. I think I'd describe that as a strength of theater goers. The theatre community overall is that I think we're a group of people who, by the very nature of what we do, actually cope with uncertainty very well. You know, shifting shows being greenlit and cancelled, or becoming hits when you didn't think they would, or becoming failures when we expected otherwise, etc. So I think as an industry, we're probably compared to many wired to cope emotionally with uncertainty. But that challenge is very great for all of us. It is worrying when you hear conversations around the world about what would a comeback look like for different countries, and, you know, generally there's language tagged on that says that sort of public gatherings will be one of the last to come back, and, you know, we're all kind of wondering what that's going to mean. And, you know, where 8 weeks felt okay, then, you know, the end of June felt reasonable, and now September feels, you know, like the new part of the conversation, and then I hear people starting to talk about later than that. So you know, just trying to plan, you know, just thinking about Moulin Rouge specifically, planning for that, if we got to go ahead, the kind of just ramping up, trying to cast, you know, five productions at once, and that kind of train wreck that's going to inevitably happen with our scheduling of the creative team, etc. You know, I just said to Bill yesterday, I'm so sick of talking about different scenarios. I've got to sort of keep them hovering in the back of our minds, but not really kind of spend too much time actually planning them all at the moment. I do think the challenge is really going to be to continue to show real grace and real courage in leadership. And I think a lot about the role of leadership at a time like this, at the political level, and then also just even at our own company level. I have a great love of Winston Churchill, so I often just, when I can't take it anymore, I just sort of go and have a little read of something related to Winston Churchill and what his sort of wartime leadership looked like and what his values were, and I think they're sort of a good blueprint for leadership going forward. But certainly, you know, I think to also keep kind of radical and innovative thinking alive at a time where we seem to be living, you know, at a very conservative moment with government around the world. I think that ultimately will be the challenge to be bold and innovative in our thinking and to keep truth alive. You know, I think that would probably be the ultimate challenge I find now. And I really observe America very closely, and I think, you know, finding truth. And for us, Moulin Rouge has been very much about truth. That, for me, would remain one of the biggest challenges. Yeah.
And what, for the theatre industry specifically, gives you cause for hope as you look ahead?
Well, I mean, at a kind of, you know, macro or level, I think the thing that gives me hope is that human beings have such an incredible capacity to be hopeful. Long before this crisis, something that really strikes me about people is how it must be a survival instinct we've got to be hopeful about our futures. And then, you know, when I look to our industry specifically, I did comment a little earlier about how I think we are wired to deal with uncertainty and change. It's sort of at the core of what we do. So I think I think that probably is a skill set puts us in good stead. And you know, as a mother, it's sort of one of the core skills I've tried to give my children, thinking, okay, what will this generation need as they grow older? And I think it will be a capacity to deal with change. So for our business, you know, that's going to be a real opportunity. And I, you know, I had this virtual tour, technical tour of the Australian theatres with Derek McLean the other day, who's a set designer for Moulin Rouge. And I just thought, wow, we normally would have spent, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 and God knows what kind of carbon footprint flying a creative team to come here and assess theatres, and we did it by Zoom, and actually it was pretty great. So I think those sort of things, you know, give us an opportunity to look at how we're doing business economically and just in terms of the environment as well. And then, you know, I guess art has a habit of thriving during bad times, oppression, catastrophe, etc. So, you know, I think we're really going to see, hopefully, the fruit of this experience show itself in some pretty unique work that will come out of it, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, we will look forward to what from Global Creatures emerges from this, including Moulin Rouge.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great really to talk to you, Carmen. Thanks for chatting.
No problem.
That was Carmen Pavlovich, the CEO of Global Creatures and a lead producer of Moulin Rouge. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe and find past episodes there and on all the other pod places, including Spotify and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.